welcome everybody to the F-Ball NFL Podcast. I'm your host, Andrea Hengst. I cover the NFL for BleacherReport.com, Scout.com's Orange and Brown Report, and Sports on Earth. I'm joined, like always, by my co-host, Brian.
Good evening.
Good evening. We are just shy of 7 days away from not just the Hall of Fame induction for the 2015 class, but also the very next day, the Hall of Fame game, the first preseason game of the year between the Pittsburgh Steelers and the Minnesota Vikings. Football is in the air.
It's a week and a half from real, actual football being played that's not Canadian or on a small field.
But only real, actual football to a point, because you know that as soon as everybody gets over being like, yeah, football is back, like on Twitter and stuff, when the game starts, people are just going to be like, all right, this is trash. I don't know who these people are who are playing in this game. Click.
That'll be somewhere around halfway through the second quarter.
Halfway through the second quarter. We will all lose interest once again. But training camps are underway. It's more than just the Vikings and the Steelers who opened their camp last Saturday. Day by day, more and more teams are hitting the field, taking to the practice field. Some wearing pads, some not just yet. But we're getting there. We're getting to the meat of the NFL offseason here with training camp. So it's very exciting.
Yes.
And in order to get us even more excited about the upcoming season, we're continuing our divisional preview series here at the F-Ball NFL Podcast this week. We're going to have the inimitable Chris Hansen of Raiders Blog. .com. He's going to be joining us to break down the AFC West, the San Diego Chargers, Denver Broncos, Oakland Raiders, of course, and Kansas City Chiefs. So stay tuned here in a little bit for that.
Yeah.
But before we get to that part of our show, we would be remiss if we did not discuss what happened on Tuesday.
Yeah, I guess we have to.
We do. We have to discuss it. It's a big deal. On Tuesday, which, again, is not a very common day for the NFL to break major news. Generally, Wednesdays or Fridays seem to be what they prefer. But on Tuesday, Roger Goodell, the National Football League, confirmed the 4-game suspension that was handed down to Tom Brady, Patriots quarterback Tom Brady, for his alleged role in ordering the deflation of footballs slightly below the league-mandated PSI way back, if you'll recall, during the AFC Championship game, which, again, if you'll recall, the Patriots handily defeated the Indianapolis Colts, and I don't think that the pressure of the football did anything to influence the outcome of that game one way or the other. But regardless, I suppose rules are rules. The problem is that the thing is, rules are rules is one thing, but the punishment when people violate these rules are very arbitrary, as we've known for the entire time Roger Goodell has been commissioner of the National Football League, dating before the 2011 CBA, back when he was, you know, assessing fines on Steelers linebacker James Harrison that he wouldn't assess on other people for doing the same things and stuff like that. And that continues all the way through what happened with Ray Rice, what happened with Greg Hardy. Basically, Roger Goodell has and the National Football League have determined that because Tom Brady not only did not give up a cell phone containing text messages that could incriminate himself, he also allegedly destroyed said cell phone. Now, Brady said the phone was already broken and that destroying used cell phones is something that he does on the regular, which wouldn't surprise me because it sounds like a high-profile person like Tom Brady, who is married to a very, very famous and wealthy supermodel, would do. But basically, because the NFL lacked evidence, they believed that the evidence of Tom Brady destroying the phone was somehow evidence that he did what they alleged he did with footballs. And for that reason, the NFL upheld the suspension. Unsurprisingly, of course, the NFL Players Association, the Players Union, on behalf of Tom Brady, filed a lawsuit initially that was filed in Minnesota, which is a very player-friendly place in terms of lawsuits and trying to, you know, trying to influence the league, very, very player-friendly. But because the NFL had already filed a preemptive lawsuit asking for the decision to be upheld in a Manhattan courtroom, New York federal judge Richard Berman, so that is now the venue in which both the NFL and the NFLPA's lawsuits or whatever will be heard, arguments will be heard. But most interestingly, Robert Kraft, the owner of the Patriots, and Patriots quarterback Tom Brady, they both released some statements. Robert Kraft taking the podium before the Patriots opened training camp on Wednesday, saying, quote, "I was wrong to put my faith in the league. Given the facts, evidence, and laws of science that underscore this entire situation, it's completely incomprehensible to me that the league continues to take steps to disparage one of its all-time great players and a man for whom I have the utmost respect. Personally, this is very sad and disappointing to me." He also said that he'll never understand why an initial erroneous report regarding the initial PSI levels of footballs, which was leaked by a source in the NFL a few days after the AFC Championship game, was never corrected by those who had the correct information. For 4 months, that report cast aspersions and shaped public opinion. He also said that he should have sued the league then when the punishment came down. He assumed that by accepting the $1 million fine and the loss of draft picks that the organization was handed down by the league, that would somehow be enough and would vacate Brady's suspension, but that has not been the case. Tom Brady, of course, he issued a statement as well on Facebook saying, "I replaced my broken Samsung phone with a new iPhone 6 after my attorneys made it clear to the NFL that my actual phone device would not be subjected to investigation under any circumstances." It's important to note that is well within Tom Brady's right. The National Football League, regardless of what they like to do and say and act like, they are not a law enforcement agency. They cannot compel anybody to
they don't have subpoena power.
They don't have subpoena power. They can't compel anybody to give up their own personal belongings in order to try to find some sort of evidence to suggest that they did something wrong. Tom Brady was completely within his rights to refuse to give that cell phone up. And I'm completely in support of Tom Brady, noting this. I respect the commissioner's authority, but he also has to respect the CBA and my rights as a private citizen. I will not allow my unfair discipline to become a precedent for other NFL players without a fight. He also did not want to relinquish the phone because that would set a negative precedent for all other players in the National Football League to give up their personal private property and information for investigations that are not of a legal nature, but are just of a National Football League nature, which I think is completely correct, because this would screw things up for the entire players' union, every single player in the National Football League, if he turned in that phone, which he didn't have to do.
I mean, the only argument against that is that Goodell and the NFL don't really care about precedents.
No, they do not care about precedent.
You could potentially argue that whatever Brady did wouldn't be a precedent for anything because the NFL doesn't care about precedents. But regardless, I certainly agree with what you're saying.
So basically what the NFLPA and Tom Brady are asking for is for a decision to be reached, either vacating his suspension or having an injunction put into place that puts off the four-game suspension, that they would like to have that happen by September 4th, which is 6 days before September 10th, which is the season opener with the Pittsburgh Steelers traveling to Foxborough to take on the Patriots. The more I look at this, I'm not sitting here saying I'm a Patriots fan and that's why I think this is a bunch of hooey. I think this is a bunch of hooey because it is.
I can attest, by the way, to the audience out there, that Andrea is not a Patriots fan by any stretch. As a matter of fact, she's unreasonably rooted against the Patriots, if anything.
Yes, I've been unreasonable at times in my rooting against the Patriots. So I don't want to be lumped in with a Patriots lover. And that's because for some reason some people think the only way that you can defend Tom Brady, the New England Patriots, here is because you're a fan of that team and of that player, and that is not my situation. My situation here is that the NFL is overstepping its authority. Mm-hmm. My point here is that the NFL is arguing that they have no precedent for someone doing this tampering with the football, and so they are making an equivalency, okay, tampering with the football to get a competitive advantage is the same thing as a first-time PED violation, and that's why Tom Brady has a four-game suspension. Never mind that, and this is from the NFLPA's filing, referencing the CBA here, This is because the player policies actually given out and made applicable to players provide only for specific collectively bargained fines for equipment violations, including those aimed at obtaining a competitive advantage. For example, the player policies provide that, quote, a player may not use unauthorized foreign substances, e.g. stickum or slippery compounds, on his body or uniform, and that such a violation affects the integrity of the competition and can give a team an unfair advantage. First-time offenders of this player rule, however, are only subject to a fine of $8,268. The player policies, by the way, involving equipment violations, also contain a catch-all provision for, quote, other uniform/equipment violations. Okay? So so there is a policy in place, and it's the first time a player willingly, knowingly commits a uniform or equipment violation for the intent of affecting the integrity of the competition and giving a team an unfair advantage, they're fined $8,268. So that should be the punishment levied down on Brady. Furthermore,
that's assuming they could prove he did it.
Furthermore, they haven't proved that to beyond it's we just sort of think that's what happened.
Beyond unreasonable doubts, they
right.
haven't.
And then keep in mind also in last year, the Panthers, I think it was last year, the Carolina Panthers and the Minnesota Vikings were both using sideline heaters to warm footballs during games, which is another violation of the uniform and equipment rules. They were just given a warning. They were not even fined. In 2012, the San Diego Chargers had an adhesive substance that was found on their game day in-game footballs. They didn't even give up these footballs when the NFL ordered them to do so. And the franchise as a whole was fined $20,000. This is in 2012. Okay? So when you look at the precedents that are already set for quote-unquote competitive, unfair competitive advantage violations involving equipment, the punishments in the past couple of years have ranged from a warning to a $20,000 fine. The Atlanta Falcons with the pumping in of crowd noise. They didn't lose a bunch of draft picks, correct?
Mm-hmm.
They weren't fined $1 million, correct?
Nope.
So it doesn't make any sense to me. That's why there is a level of this where it feels like a witch hunt. And really, it's not a witch hunt against Brady. I think it's just another way for Roger Goodell to put his foot on the throat of the players' union.
Asserting authority.
Asserting his authority over the players' union because he can. Because it's a very weak union, because there's only so much that these players are going to do to fight for when there's not a lot of job security when it comes to the NFL to begin with. It also seems like this is another setup for another big power play that the league is going to try to make because, we're not too far off from another CBA negotiation starting up.
We're roughly halfway through, right?
We're roughly halfway through, so, it's all very far downhill from here. So you put all of these things together, and it just seems like another example of Roger Goodell arbitrarily exerting his will over a player and an organization and the players' union. The preemptive filing asking for the decision to be upheld even before Brady and the players' union filed their lawsuit is also indicative of them just trying to do something to stick it to the union more than they're actually concerned about what happens if you slightly deflate a football.
Right.
Especially because the deflated footballs, A, were reinflated to the proper PSI at halftime, and B, had nothing to do with the complete stomping that the Patriots put on the Colts in that AFC Championship game.
Very true.
The punishment does not fit the crime here. The punishment doesn't even fit the cover-up, the alleged cover-up, because Brady already told them, you're not going to get that phone. He destroys that phone. He doesn't destroy that phone.
It doesn't matter.
They're not getting the phone.
And
it's a straw man argument.
The whole thing, for me, it boils down rather simply. The NFL chose to make this a deal.
Yes.
They've obviously, like you mentioned previously.
This is the mountain that Goodell feels like dying on right now.
He needed to make this mountain, certainly.
He created the mountain, and now he's going
to. Yeah, the question is why, and I think that you have, I think that what you're saying is very plausible. I kind of feel like there's probably some other factors in
there
too.
There's got to be something else.
I think that's definitely very well could be part of it.
I mean, there was the allegations of ownership pressuring Goodell to keep the punishment as stands, including Ravens owner Steve Bisciotti and Colts owner Jim Irsay. Bisciotti, though, he's released a statement saying that is patently false, And we were talking about this earlier. Do you think that just Jim Irsay can get Roger Goodell to do anything at this point?
I would find that hard to believe.
No, I don't think so. And you know, if that were the case, with all the different arbitrary punishments that Goodell has handed down throughout his tenure as commissioner, why is this the first time we've heard owners are pressuring Goodell to do this or that about a ruling on an appeal?
Yeah, and I don't know. You'd upset half of the other owners, I'd say, just like singling out. I don't know. That's a stretch.
But there's obviously some
sort of
agenda.
Why are you catering only certain guys? Yeah, exactly. But that's what I'm saying. Yeah. There's an agenda. I don't know exactly what it is. I think maybe the union busting is certainly sounds like one of the most plausible things
heard
of. Yeah, and that's probably at least part of it. But I mean, again, this is really simple. They created this. This is obviously something they didn't care about in the past because they didn't ever have any sort of crazy issue with. This was never any damage to the integrity of the game when other teams or other players did this.
Right.
But for some reason, the Patriots are doing it, and Brady's doing it, and they need to turn this into this spectacle that it's become. And
for some reason, it takes 6 to 7 months for them to sort this out.
And well, see, I'm a conspiracy theorist at times, and I've since this whole thing started, I've been saying this just seems like a smokescreen to me to be some story for everybody to talk about during the off season. So that way, when players are getting arrested or punching people or whatever, that's a back burner issue to Deflategate. You know what I mean? But at the same time, now we're kind of this is getting so drawn out, and it's being taken to that extreme level that I kind of feel like that's probably even a flawed theory there. So I don't understand exactly why they're doing this, but they obviously created this situation. Then it seems like they didn't get enough evidence in their investigation to actually lean on that when they're saying that this suspension should be upheld. So they're going to lean on the fact that he broke a phone, which he told him he was never going to give him anyway, and he didn't have to.
No, he was under no circumstances of having to give up that phone. And giving up that phone would have been a terrible precedent set for the entire player, every single player in the NFL. Mm-hmm. I can't stress that enough. That sets a new precedent of when the NFL, who has no legal authority to say, give me your phone, and then you do. Now they have authority to get your phone.
Potentially, it seems somewhat of a stretch to say just because Brady did it that somehow the other players would be compelled to, even though they still legally don't have to.
No, but if he gave it up and then he had his penalty reduced because he said, okay, I'll give you the phone, and then someone says, no, we're not giving you the phone, then they can be like, well, you're not cooperating, and so you're screwed.
Exactly. But this kind of sets a precedent for the other way. So
sure.
Of saying that you better do things that are beyond your rights, or you're not gonna get your appeal. You're not gonna get any sort of reduction in your suspension or anything like that.
Sure.
So, I don't know. I thought this was a dumb story since it came out. I never understood.
It's a stupid rule and it's a stupid violation of a stupid rule.
Teams should be able to do whatever they want.
Really matter.
If they
do whatever you want to the football.
Or make it like the K balls when they came out for the kickers of it comes out hermetically sealed and nobody touches it before the game. Either they're all exactly the same or let them do what they want. Aaron Rodgers doesn't even like an underinflated ball. He likes his to be overinflated, if anything.
Jeff Blake, he was a quarterback in the NFL from 92 to 2005. He played for Arizona Cardinals, amongst others. Admitted that practically every quarterback in the NFL did it. They had a little needle. They would take air out of the footballs all the time. He personally would order ball boys to do it. Sound familiar?
Yeah.
And no one ever got in trouble then.
And that's what I'm saying.
Because it doesn't really matter.
This is such a minor issue.
I mean, I guess I understand that it's a rule, but it's also a pointless
rule. But it's also a rule that supposedly has a fine associated with it of roughly $8,000. Not $1 million to the team. Plus two draft picks,
including a first rounder. This is not cheating. This isn't even the same thing as them videotaping signals. The quote unquote Spygate. This is not even close to that in level of severity.
I just want to caution people out there that are. And I think a lot of it is just hate for the Patriots, which
sure.
I understand why there's a lot of hate for the Patriots.
I get it.
But if you think about this. Who is the inherently more evil party here? It's Goodell and the NFL.
If you're rushing to believe their
side of this story, then you're probably not thinking this thing quite through, and you're acting on your own emotions for the Patriots more than than you are on what is probably the truth.
Goodell
because
is not
this makes no sense.
Goodell's not selectively evil or bad, or the NFL as an organization is not just selectively evil and bad. All of it is bad. Anytime you're talking about billions of dollars, something evil is happening. It's a fact. You can't have billions of dollars without doing terrible things
to acquire it. And the other thing too is that everybody's you know, Brady's this cheater, and I'm thinking like, one, if he did this, which again, it's probably true, but I don't know,
yeah,
and it wasn't proven.
And even the league has said that in their ruling of just like it's more probable than not that he did, so they don't really even know.
So they don't know without a doubt that he did this. He probably did it, or probably had some part in it. But again, who cares? But like outside of that, he's on a team that got caught for the Spygate thing, and so he's a cheater. So because the team, the Spygate thing, honestly, to me, it seems way worse than this.
Yeah,
way worse.
Absolutely worse. And that is an absolute provable competitive advantage.
Yes, and so they find them, and they were the team was labeled cheaters and all that, and I think that was more rightfully so than this cements Brady's legacy as a cheater. And it's just, it's like, come on. I mean, the rival fans, get over yourselves, you know? Come on. What is so bad about this other than your hatred for Tom Brady?
Yes. Redirect that hatred towards Roger Goodell. He's the one who deserves it. Honestly.
I completely agree.
Honestly.
I just.
And this is pretty much all the breath that we are going to waste on this topic until there is a ruling one way or the other
so
in court,
done.
Whenever that may happen, whether it's September 4th, before that, or later.
And that's the thing. It's like they just wanted to drag out forever, you know? So we could just talk about a slight underinflation of PSI for the next 2 years. You know what I mean? It's just going to be main topic of conversation unless there's something, you know, actually
more
going
inane
on.
That happens.
Yeah, right.
All right, well, we are going to take a quick break here in the F-Ball NFL podcast, cool down a little bit, and then we'll be back with Chris Hansen of Raiders Blog. We're going to be talking all about the AFC West here in our divisional preview series, so stay tuned. We'll be right back here on the F-Ball NFL podcast.
Oh, yeah.
I'm disappearing like Jimmy Hoffa, AK-47. My business partner, business is well. French kiss a bitch, she don't speak French, can't kiss and tell. I push his ass in the wishing well, then wish him well. Sipping syrup like ginger ale, but I'm the quickest snail. From here to hell, I hear them hail, I give them hell. I'm spitting hell, I'm Clinton, well, I did inhale. Niggas frail, they Chippendales, they little gals. Watch me act a donkey, then pin the tail, spit out your nails. Glory, hallelujah.
Our divisional preview series here at the F-Ball NFL podcast continues this week with the AFC West. And who better to join us than Chris Hansen from Raiders Blog and, of course, a longtime AFC West specialist for Bleacher Report. Welcome back to the podcast.
Yeah,
Chris.
Welcome.
How's it going?
Good, good. It's good to have you back here here at the F-Ball NFL podcast and talking about, of course, the AFC West.
Oh, yes, the great AFC West. I think it's going to be quite the competitive division this year, so it's going to be a very fun season.
Yeah, I think that there's a lot to pay attention to here in this division, a lot to like. Let's start with the Denver Broncos, who went 12-4. In the 2014 season. Of course, one of the biggest storylines surrounding the Broncos at this point is, of course, the changing of the coaching staff. John Fox is gone. Gary Kubiak is in as head coach. Rick Dennison is his offensive coordinator. Wade Phillips has come in to be the defensive coordinator. What are the dynamics here between Kubiak, Dennison, and quarterback Peyton Manning? Because I recall at some point earlier in the offseason, reporters asking Peyton Manning about his preferences about the offense and his thoughts on the offense, and he kind of brushed them off and said, you know, this isn't my offense, don't ask me. So is he feeling a little miffed about the coaching change and you know, bringing in a guy who's obviously very run heavy like Kubiak, or is it just kind of just some random flippant comment that Manning made?
Maybe, you know, sometimes it can be tough to tell with Manning, but I think he genuinely, this isn't his offense. And for the first time, maybe, you know, since maybe his rookie year, he's really running an offense that isn't his offense. I mean, he's had so much input into the offense that was run before. I know Mike McCoy, obviously, you know, now with the Chargers, obviously it was part his offense, but when he really gave Peyton the reins, the offense kind of took off, and that's kind of worked out. And then, you know, Adam Gase sort of never even questioned it, just kind of let Peyton run with it. And obviously, it's a collaborative effort, but it's all what Peyton likes to do. And this offense is different for Peyton. And so, yeah, it's a little bit, you know, I don't think he's, you know, necessarily that miffed about it, but when people ask him about it, I mean, he's like, well, you know, it's not really mine. I'm not taking ownership of this, in terms of this is the plays we're running. I'm going to play, I'm going to be the best quarterback I can be in this system, and, you know, do what I can to make this team win. And that's a little bit a tough pill to swallow for somebody like Peyton Manning, but I think John Elway thinks that it's going to be good for Peyton Manning to basically, okay, the pressure's not on you to, it's not your offense. You know, it's Kubiak's offense. You're going to run the plays. You're going to execute the plays. And guess what? Peyton Manning is pretty good about that stuff. Still, a lot of people, you know, obviously the playoff drought and all that, but yeah, Peyton Manning's still a pretty good quarterback. So I think John Elway thinks that this is going to work. This little marriage is going to work.
Plus, with Kubiak's offense being so run heavy and run intensive, that does take a lot of pressure off of Peyton Manning, because, you know, Peyton Manning, there's pretty much, you know, no one who can compare to his football knowledge and his ability to read defenses and things like that when he's on the field. But there's also no denying that he's getting older. The arm strength isn't what it used to be. He's had so many neck surgeries and things that have affected that arm strength on top of just getting older. So it does benefit him, you know, to be in this system that can maximize his strengths and minimize his weaknesses. And I think, you know, we kind of saw hints of that. You know, we see it all the time with Kubiak. We saw it with him and Matt Schaub in Houston, and we saw him last year with Joe Flacco and you know, with a Ravens team that didn't have a lot of weaponry, but they did have a very effective running back in Justin Forsett. So, you know, being very, very, you know, C.J. Anderson heavy, very run heavy, at the very least allows him to, you know, maximize what is still working best about his passing offense.
Exactly. And, you know, that part of Peyton Manning's game where he's at the line of scrimmage and he's reading a defense, that's not going to change.
Right.
Now, what may change a little bit is he might have three or four plays that he can check to from that are Kubiak's plays, but he's still reading the defense. He's still adjusting to the whatever, the cover two beater, or, you know, adjusting to a run or whatever. He's still doing those things. So he's still using his skill set. The difference is, you know, he's not changing the entire play to a play that he, you know, that was never called, you know, in the huddle or anything like that. And that's the kind of latitude he had in the past. And, you know, that's the kind of latitude he probably will not have. And so it's a little bit of a change, but ultimately both philosophies can be effective. We've seen that in the NFL. And so it'll be a little bit of adjustment period. I think it'll be interesting to see early in the season just how much Peyton is taking to it, and, you know, how much of that, you know, offense is he changing at the line? How much of those gyrations is he still doing at the line of scrimmage?
Right.
And I'm guessing a lot, because some of those are, or I should say a lot of those are really just to throw the defense off.
The question mark, though, I have really with this offense is the offensive line. We have Ryan Clady, the left tackle, tearing his ACL in OTAs. He's done for the year. Now it looks like they're putting in a rookie potentially at left tackle, Tyson Brallo. And then there's, you know, question marks at the right tackle position as well. How do you see that playing out over the course of the summer, and how do you think that's going to affect not just Peyton Manning in the passing game, but also the ability to run the ball so heavily?
Well, I think the last part is the important part,
yeah.
You know, in this offense. I mean, Peyton Manning has shown, I mean, he's pretty much had consistently below average pass blockers on his offensive line almost his whole career, and it's never really affected him that much.
He gets the ball up pretty quickly.
Yeah,
he gets the ball out so quick. It's really not an issue there. Where you start talking about is if he does take a couple hits, though, that body is not as equipped to handle those things as they used to be. So
right.
You start to worry. I mean, he takes so few hits, but the few that he takes, you could worry about those a little bit with an offensive line that's a little shaky, obviously at the tackle spots especially. And, you know, how is it going to shake out? It's a good question, because you got Chris Clark and Ryan Harris is obviously a guy that they brought in, but these are guys that they think feel like they can be good run blockers, mm-hmm. in this zone system. But they obviously are a little bit concerned about it because they're kind of putting the feelers out on Jake Long. They had him in for a visit, and they're going to kind of see where that goes. So I think they're more concerned now about right tackle. They really like Tyson Braylor. They really like Tyson Braylor. He was probably a shoe-in to be the right tackle even before. Now he's on the left side. Maybe that weakens the left side a little bit, but really where the weakness is okay, now what do we do with the right side? And, interesting because Chris Clark just a couple years ago, filled in for Clady pretty admirably. But different philosophies come in and guys, they develop or don't develop, and now they kind of have him as a major question mark. So it's going to be really interesting to see how will it shake out. Well, I think Ryan Harris actually probably has the leg up on the right tackle spot right now. But if they bring Jake Long, obviously I think they'd be bringing in him to start. So we'll say I have to keep an eye on that. If a couple weeks goes by and they end up signing him, you probably have your answer about what they think of their right tackles.
Moving to the defensive side of the ball, on at linebacker, you've got Trevathan and Brandon Marshall, who are working their way back from injuries last year. They drafted Shane Ray, obviously still have DeMarcus Ware and Von Miller there. To me, it looks like the main focus of this Denver defense right now is getting the front seven to be pretty aggressive. And that's something, that Wade Phillips in particular, their new coordinator, is also something that he really quite likes. Where do you see all of these pieces fitting in? And especially when you've got guys like Danny Trevathan and Marshall coming back from those injuries as well.
Yeah, well, those guys were obviously key in Del Rio's defense. And I think one of the reasons they were so key, Trevathan and Brandon Marshall, was they were great in coverage. In Wade Phillips, he's going to blitz a lot more than Del Rio did. Del Rio didn't blitz very much. He was very effective when he did, but he didn't do it very much.
Right.
Phillips is going to get after people. And when you do that, you put a lot more pressure on those linebackers, especially the ones that are dropping into coverage. Now they're singled up. They may not have help over the top. Because that safety might have to be covering somebody else. So, obviously it creates the opportunity for the defense to be really good, but also potentially gives up more big plays if those linebackers don't hold up. And since they're both coming off injury, that's where you might say, okay, maybe this defense up the middle isn't as strong as it was last year. You talk about Terrence Knighton being gone, right? The guys in front of those inside linebackers, not quite there. So they're really going to have to, win with disruption. Now, you have a good offense and you have the kind of players that they do on the outside. And when we talk about Von Miller and DeMarcus Ware, and you add Shane Ray to that, they can get creative, bring, some of those guys inside. That's a recipe for a very good defense. But it'll be interesting to see if they end up giving up, some big plays, in the process. They might make some big ones and might be a little bit more of a boom or bust defense than last year, where it was just almost you didn't realize how good it was just because they were just kind of solid all the time. So I think that's where it'll kind of change, but they certainly still have plenty of talent on that side of the ball.
Moving on to the 9-7 Kansas City Chiefs. The one thing that I really wonder about with the Chiefs is this offense. The stat that everybody, seems to remember very clearly is that no wide receiver caught a touchdown pass for the Chiefs last year. Now they don't have Dwayne Bowe. They bring in Jeremy Maclin. They got Jason Avant there. All of a sudden, a 5'9" undrafted rookie from a year ago, I believe, Albert Wilson, looks to be heading into a starting job there. There's Travis Kelce at the tight end position. But then, I just question this receiving core, especially because, this is an offense that's about protecting the football and also running so well behind Jamaal Charles. But Jamaal Charles, he's had some nagging injuries. It's potential that he could slow down this year. What are you seeing, where this offense is headed for this season?
Well, really, it's an offense that's perfectly tailored to Alex Smith and what he likes to do. And that's get the ball out quickly. They don't have a good offensive line. We know that, at least not from a pass protection standpoint. He's going to get the ball out quickly. He's going to get the ball in the hands of his playmakers. And he's got a bunch of yards after the catch type players. He's got Travis Kelce is a big yard after the catch tight end.
Mm-hmm.
Maclin, that's pretty much the way that he thrives as well. And then Albert Wilson, you talk about, but they also have other weapons. They've got, obviously, you've got Jamaal Charles, who's a weapon out of the backfield. But, you've got all these different guys. You got DeAnthony Thomas is another guy they're going to work in. Chris mm-hmm. Conley, this is a speedster wide receiver rookie. They kind of have high hopes for him as well. So you start thinking about it, and they're like, okay, they could piece together a decent offense just, you know, getting the ball out quick and letting those guys make plays. And Andy Reid is one of the best at kind of creating space, horizontal space for his receivers to you know, make plays for him. So I think they'll be okay. I think obviously you're still limited by Alex Smith a little bit,
right.
Just because you obviously a good defense is going to be able to clamp down on those yards after the catch. And, you know, that's where they'll struggle a little bit. But still could be a pretty solid offense. And certainly teams that don't tackle well, and we know that the NFL, you know, tackling fundamentals are down.
Yes.
They're really degrading over the years. So certainly certain teams are going to struggle against them because, you know, they are going to get in space and they got some quick guys. So I think they'll be okay. But obviously might not be too flashy, but I think they're going to be pretty solid.
Yeah, flashy has never been the adjective for Alex Smith or the way that he throws or handles an offense. So so as long as they don't get too flashy, he can handle it.
Right.
The other thing that interests me, though, on the offense is that pretty much the entire right side of the offensive line is up for grabs right now, guard and tackle. You know, how do you see that playing out over the course of the summer?
Gosh, because I have no idea. You're talking about there's so many guys that they could – There's so many guys, and you know, I could name right now, but no one on your podcast probably ever heard of half the guys that I mentioned. So, really, it is up for grabs, and you mentioned that, and it really anybody could start there. But I think that one of the things that you have to keep in mind, again, we kind of go back to what we're talking about with the Broncos, is can they help them run the ball?
Right.
The guys that are going to do well are going to be guys that can help Jamal Charles, you know, create space for Jamal Charles, because. Again, Alex Smith, not quite to the level of Peyton Manning, obviously, but he's a guy that's going to get the ball out quickly. You know, he's not going to hold the ball very long. Even if he has protection, he's not going to hold the ball very long. So, you know, they just want some, you know, blockers that, hey, execute your assignments. You know, maybe you're not the most physically gifted guy, but execute your assignments. Obviously, work in tandem, you know, in a lot of the zone blocking, and then, you know, we'll get Jamal Charles going, and you get Jamal Charles going, use play action, and you get the rest of the offense going. So, you know, how is it going to shake out? You know, I have no idea. Again, I have just this one. It's one of those ones where you just have no idea till training camp gets going how it's going to, you know, shake out in terms of which guys are going to really emerge there. Because really there's, you know, maybe four different guys that could end up starting on the right side of that offensive line.
Yes. Four. And like you said, four guys I've never really heard of. So.
Right. So. They did improve at guard a little bit. They're still rolling with Fisher on the other side. So, you know, obviously they've got some guys that they feel like, okay, at least these are guys they're stable. They may not be great players, you know, at this stage of their career or yet, or with Fisher. I don't really have high hopes that he's going to turn into anything spectacular. But, you know, they at least feel like they have some solid guys there, and then they can worry about the other positions.
Is there any concern about Jamal Charles in terms of wear and tear you know, the little injuries that have piled up over the years and the big injury, the ACL from a couple years ago? Any concern of him slowing down, or is he just he's just one of those kind of super freak new kind of running backs in the, you know, like Marshawn Lynch, Adrian Peterson and Frank Gore, where age just doesn't seem to
– The robots.
Yeah, they're robots, and their age doesn't affect them.
You know, I think it will. I think it will affect Charles a little bit. I mean, you know, Charles isn't the biggest running back,
no.
And a lot of his game is speed, not power, like you would probably quantify for Lynch. You know, even Peterson to some extent, a lot of his game is power. So you talk about Charles, and you know, as a guy that's a speed guy, so I think he's going to slow down a little bit. And we showed maybe he was showing a little bit of slowdown last year. Obviously, we talked about many injuries, but that's just the way that the NFL is, and the guys. You know, have to be able to kind of work through that. So, you know, I think it might slow down a little bit, and that's part of the reason that they went out and got a guy like Jeremy Maclin. So that way the passing offense could be a little bit better because they need to, you know, they can't continue to give him the volume that they, you know, gave him year before last. I mean, he was a ridiculous percentage of their offense. And so, you know, they got to kind of transition some of that. If they successfully do so, then, you know, I think Charles can be real effective because he's not going to have to carry as much of the load. But if they aren't real effective and they have to ride him, then that's where you, you know, get concerned. Now, Andy Reid's never usually been too, accused of riding his running backs too hard. So
right.
I think it'll probably be, I think it'll probably be where they do try to kind of move away from, you know, making him 47% of the offense or something crazy like that. Right. It was 2 years ago.
On the defensive side of the ball, there's some good news this week with Eric Berry being cleared. He's cancer-free. He's back. He can participate in training camp, which is great news. It's great news for the Chiefs, for their defense. It's even better news for Berry and his health. They also drafted Marcus Peters, the cornerback, this year. Derek Johnson, he had an Achilles tear last year, and he's 33 years old. So where are you seeing the direction of this defense going now?
You know, it's a good question. This is a defense where they've been so good for quite a few years. Mm-hmm. And you do have to start wondering, okay, can they keep up the level of play that they've had? I mean, I think Poe last year wasn't quite what he was, but you have Mike DeVito coming in back from injury, and he's going to help him on the defensive line. And they think they like Jay Howard and all that. Alan Bailey's a guy that they really like on the defensive line. So I think they've got enough young talent there. Obviously, you know, you start talking about, you know, guys like Justin Houston, no, you know, don't have much worries about him.
No.
Tom Bahali's a guy that, you know, maybe he's lost a little bit, but still a veteran who's going to be able to get the job done.
Yes.
So really where you're talking about, okay, where they had problems last year, Derek Johnson, and then in the secondary. You know, Derek Johnson, the inside linebacker, they didn't have him last year, and it hurt. To have him back this year is going to be huge, but you mentioned 33, Achilles injury. A lot of guys never come back from Achilles injuries the same way that they did before. So very, very concerning considering his age. But all the reports so far is that he looks pretty good. So you have to like their odds of having a top defense again. And then they also beefed up that secondary a little bit. Obviously, Philip Gaines, Marcus Peters, they're going to have some competition at the cornerback spot. But they've got enough guys there where they can really, you know, kind of, you know, make a name for themselves. Those guys have a chance. Obviously, they feel like this is probably Sean Smith's last year, but they still do have him, a solid player. So they have enough on that defense, I think, to still be a very good unit. If not an elite unit, a very, very good unit.
Moving on to the San Diego Chargers, who also went 9-7 in the 2014 season. Big thing to talk about here is that the Chargers decided to go for it and got running back Melvin Gordon in the first round, maybe trying to find themselves a new LaDainian Tomlinson type. You know, he's joining a pretty decent group of running backs when you know, with Danny Woodhead, Donald Brown, Brandon Oliver, but they're not going to be able to keep all four and kind of focus their rushing offense around all four. So who would you think would be the most in danger now that Gordon is there and you know, is probably going to live up to at least some degree of the hype?
Well, I think in terms of carries, at the very least, and Donald Brown, I think is a guy that, you know, when they signed him last year, the contract that they signed him to pretty much put off a majority of his salary till this year.
Yeah.
And I think they kind of envision him taking over for Ryan Matthews this year, or kind of transitioning to him as the number one. And then he kind of didn't pan out. So They went and got Melvin Gordon, which I think was a fabulous move because they really didn't have a very good rushing offense last year. Obviously, Danny Woodhead was hurt. They didn't have him, as I've heard him referred to as basically the check down demigod.
Yes.
You know, they didn't have him. So, you know, obviously, I think Donald Brown is the one who's going to lose carries. Now, he might make the roster. Probably Brandon Oliver will be the guy that is on the roster bubble. But Donald Brown's the guy that's really going to lose a lot of carries because, you know, it's going to be Melvin Gordon. And then when he's not in there, it's going to be Danny Woodhead. So, obviously, he's going to be kind of confined to that definite backup role at the most. So I think that's who loses out. But as far as Melvin Gordon, I mean, obviously he's still a rookie, but they really like him. And they really we saw how well the offense did, you know, a couple years ago when they had a good rushing offense and then kind of went off the rails last year. So to have a guy, a back like Melvin Gordon, I think that they feel like, okay, our offense is going to be really good once again. And that I'm not sure positive that's going to be the case because I still have some concerns about that offensive line, but certainly they have the running back that can make it happen.
So a lot of people kind of been waiting with bated breath for the era of tight end Ladarius Green to begin, and it looks like at least for the first four games of this season, he'll get some sort of opportunity because Antonio Gates is suspended for a PED violation. With Ladarius Green, because he's in a contract year, Antonio Gates isn't getting any younger – Is this an opportunity for Green to really take the reins of that tight end position, especially during that four-game absence? Or is he just going to be a kind of a fill-in guy for Gates, and then Gates is just going to take that, you know, take that starting job and take those snaps back immediately upon returning?
It's certainly an opportunity for Ladarius Green to show that he is. You know, the thing with Ladarius Green is you kind of feel like, man, if he was really going to show that, wouldn't he kind of have shown it already? wouldn't they have found ways to get him into the lineup if he was, you know, a worthy Gates, you know, successor? So I think,
sure,
you know, with him, I think it might be, yeah, he certainly could have some effective games with Gates out. But is he, you know, really ready to kind of take over and you know, kind of have that breakout year where, you know, when Gates comes back, they're like, nah, we don't need you, Gates? I don't think so. I think that's going to be kind of a similar situation. While Gates is out, he'll be an effective tight end, certainly one that some people would, you know, be happy to have. But when Gates gets back, especially with his long history with Phillip Rivers, he's going to come right back in and be that third down guy again. But it will be interesting to see a little bit with Danny Woodhead and Melvin Gordon back. You know, you can only have so many guys run the kind of similar patterns. Danny Woodhead, Antonio Gates, he's run these short patterns. It might be a little interesting to see if they go with some two-back sets, bring Danny Woodhead and Melvin Gordon into the picture, if that, you know, results in some fewer snaps for Ladarius Green and maybe kind of a phasing out of Gates. Obviously, most people believe this will probably be his last season. So you kind of have to keep an eye on that to see kind of those first 4 weeks. Maybe they start to use some more two-back sets and Green doesn't become that tight end that they, you know, even that tight end that produces in Gates' absence. So I wouldn't pin a whole lot of hopes on Ladarius Green. I know that, obviously, the talent, we've seen it, but you know, there's something just missing there that, you know, at this point in time, you can't think that he's just been stuck behind multiple coaches and hasn't gotten that opportunity. So I, I think at this point, you can't bank too much on him becoming that kind of player.
Plus, you have the Stevie Johnson factor to consider because, you know, he's coming in basically as the Eddie Royal replacement, and, you know, Eddie Royal, he's a receiver by trade, but he does a lot of other things. He can get carries. He can do end-arounds, things like that. And I think that, you know, in terms of size, speed, I think that Stevie Johnson would also provide a similar kind of skill set for the Chargers that could also kind of tear into whatever snaps Green could end up getting those first four games.
Yeah, it's a very interesting offense, Bill. I mean, you've got Stevie Johnson, obviously, like an Eddie Royal-type role, but I think they envision something even bigger for him as in terms of the passing game. And then you obviously have Keenan Allen coming back, and they brought in guys like Austin Pettis and drafted a guy like Titus Davis. None of these really scream deep threat, do they? So it's kind of an interesting dynamic that they have going there. Just, I feel like they probably feel like Rivers is, you know, is one of those things. They want Rivers to get the ball a little bit more quickly this year, get it to his weapons. Like I mentioned, the offensive line, I have some questions there. I feel like they don't want Rivers to be pressured because he's shown that his play falls off when he's pressured pretty significantly. It's not unusual. It's not a bad knock on Phillip Rivers. He's a very, very good quarterback, one of the best. But, you know, when he's pressured, things start going off the rails a little bit, and so they want to be able to get that ball out. So not a lot of deep balls, not a lot of deep passes to these receivers. It's going to be more kind of dink and duck type offense.
Speaking of Phillip Rivers, you know, he's very, you know, he's been very open that he is not interested in moving to or going to San Diego should the Chargers move from San Diego – or, sorry, to Los Angeles from San Diego. He's not interested in going to Los Angeles. You know, is this going to turn into a real sticking point where the Chargers are going to have to move on from Rivers if they end up in Los Angeles after this season? Or is he going to – you know, I've seen some people suggest that he could – try to retire and kind of pull a Carson Palmer when the Bengals wouldn't let him out of his contract initially. Where do you see this going with the Los Angeles thing and Phillip Rivers being the Chargers quarterback beyond 2015?
You know, I think Phillip Rivers, he's not going to have a whole lot of choices. One is because obviously when the time comes, the Chargers, if necessary, they can make sure that they retain him. Obviously, with the franchise tag, if they need that. I don't think it's going to come to that. Both sides are still talking long-term contract. They're obviously, once the season starts, you know, Phillip Rivers will probably shut that down as far as the talk. But just because he doesn't like to kind of operate that way. But, you know, yeah, he's been vocal about not wanting to go to Los Angeles. But if the team moves to Los Angeles and they take care of him contractually, I still think, you know, he'll find a way to make sure that that works for him. I mean, it's not maybe what he wants. Would the team explore a trade down the line? Maybe. But I think right now everybody's talking. He wants a long-term deal. And, you know, there's these little sticking points in every contract negotiation. Well, I'm not really liking the idea of L.A. Well, you know, when they give you a huge contract extension, L.A. is not going to start looking so bad. So,
right.
You know, I know Philip Rivers never really been about a money guy, but at the same time, I think, you know, as the team makes a long-term commitment to him, I think that's one of the things is they're moving to L.A. They haven't made a long-term commitment to him. He's kind of wondering what's going on. If they do make that long-term commitment to him, I think L.A. will look a lot more attractive if that ends up being what happens with the Chargers. It's certainly possible that Rivers signs that contract and this Los Angeles situation plays out a little longer than we anticipate. So I think that's certainly a possibility. But so right now, it's not anything that I worry about. But, you know, maybe a year, 2 years down the line, yeah, maybe it becomes an issue. But I think more is that long-term contract that is really the crux of what has kind of prompted, you know, Rivers to speak up about Los Angeles.
I think he'll be fine with L.A., assuming he can find a nice church to go to there.
He's going to have a nice church and a large house for his brood.
He can – I know he was, like, concerned about – he's got a large family, so obviously family time, driving to and from the facility there. I'm sure that they can work something out there. You know, chopper him in, whatever you have to do. You know, to get him there, I think they'll figure that out.
Something that's really struck me about the San Diego defense over the past couple of years is that while it features, you know, a good player here or there, the whole thing, the defense as a whole, is, you know, it's definitely not the Sean Merriman Chargers of you know, last decade. And I feel like they've been struggling and attempting over and over to kind of repeat that magic. They drafted Denzel Perryman, inside linebacker, this year. They're really high on outside linebacker Kyle Emanuel. They have some questions at strong safety because Marcus Gilchrist left in free agency. So what is this Chargers defense? I find myself year after year saying there's some guys here, but then when you watch it week by week, you go, but what really is this Chargers defense?
Yeah, well, I personally think that the whole thing is kind of Eric Weddle's defense. I mean, I think when Eric Weddle's playing really well, the defense plays really well.
Yeah.
And he plays really well a lot, but some obviously has better games than other times. And when he's really, really on, I think that whole defense really kind of thrives on it. But yeah, you look at the defense, you're like, this defense, how are they really doing? Because I think they lack stars, don't they? I mean, compared to a lot of defenses in the league. You know, Eric Weddle, I mean, Jason Verrett was an impressive rookie until he got hurt. Brandon Flowers is a guy, okay, you know, he's been really, really good in the past. But you look at some of these other guys, especially the linebackers, you got, you know, Manti Te'o is obviously, I think he's coming around and being solid. But Donald Butler's been kind of a bust for them when they signed him to that big contract. Melvin Ingram certainly isn't an impressive player. He's a solid player. But, you know, start looking at the defensive line, and I know they – you know, Corey Legit, I know they like him a lot and they signed him the big contract, but most people, you know, their eyebrows were raised when he got that big deal. So, you know, Kendall Reyes, obviously not a guy that's all that impressive. So you start looking at this defense, well, how are they patching it together? And I really think Weddle has been a big part of that because, as you know, in the position that he plays, you know, he has obviously helps those linebackers, he helps the defensive backs, and he's all over the place a little bit. And I think that helps them tremendously when he's good. But now they're kind of, I don't know, it seems like they're kind of pushing him out, which is a kind of an odd move at this stage. I know he's a little bit on the older side, but I don't see anybody coming in to replace him anytime soon. So it's a little bit strange that they've kind of created a combative environment with him, especially since you just don't – I mean, obviously, guy up-and-comer guys, I mean, you talk about Perryman. He's a guy that might come in and kind of take Donald Butler's job. But, you know, obviously you know, Jerry Adichow is a guy that they like a lot. They're going to pretty much rely on him for pass rush, but they don't really have much of that anywhere. So very interesting defense. They can be a solid defense, but it's a very interesting defense just because they certainly lack for big names. And, you know, that might work for them. They have some depth, I guess, but very strange kind of constructed defense. And Now, I have some questions about their secondaries, you know, beyond Brandon Flowers and Jason Verrett. You know, talk about number three, number four corners. You start having some worries there. But deep enough to where, you know, if the offensive's good, I think they'll be fine. But a very, very peculiar construction, certainly from Tom Telesco.
And finally, the 3-13 Oakland Raiders. I'm very excited to see what this Oakland Raiders team under new head coach Jack Del Rio is going to look like this year. You know, you look at that roster, and particularly a linebacker and wide receiver, the depth is very impressive. You've got Michael Crabtree, Miles Austin, Kembrell Tompkins, Chris Durham, Rod Streeter, all at wide receiver, and then they draft Amari Cooper in round one. You know, Derek Carr, I think, you know, as any rookie quarterback should, started looking better and better and better as the season wore on, and I feel like this is an offensive situation that suits him really well. You bring in a really underrated guy like Roy Helu, who can really help out the run game and the passing game, and now you're all of a sudden you're full of tight ends and fullbacks. You've drafted Clive Walford, you've got Michael Rivera, Marcel Reese. So I feel like they're really building at least a good stable of offensive weaponry for Derek Carr.
Well, it's certainly going to be more competitive for them. I mean, you talk about a team that the talent-wise, it just wasn't there last year and really hasn't been for quite a long time. And now you're like, okay, this is interesting. I mean, certainly maybe the big names are not quite there. Obviously, Amari Cooper's a guy that can turn into that. But, you know, the big names are not quite there. But you're talking about, man, there's a lot of solid players here. A guy to keep an eye on, I think, at wide receiver, Rod Streeter, is a guy that they had really high hopes for him last year, got hurt, didn't really develop into that threat that they thought. But pretty much they were relying on him to be the number one wide receiver last year. And I think when you talk about, you know, going into this year, I think they have high hopes for him again. Obviously, Crabtree's a solid player, maybe not a number one type, but, you know, obviously the last year, their number one receiver was James Jones and Andre Holmes, and now Andre Holmes is going to have to be fighting for a roster spot. So very interesting indeed how much depth they've brought in this year at those positions. And then, you know, you mentioned the tight ends, running backs. Obviously, I think the one where I'm still a little bit concerned is running back. I know a lot of people love Latavius Murray. I love his talent too. But the sample was just too small for me to be real comfortable with him as a number one back. Obviously, I think that's why they brought in Trent Richardson, although, I don't think many people have high hopes about what he can help them do. But, Roy Helu is a guy that I think, really, he's a guy that was brought in for Derek Carr's sake. And have a guy like him who can gain positive yards on checkdowns. They really didn't have that kind of guy last year at all. So Derek Carr was, the deck was stacked against him, let's be honest, last year. Now he's got some weapons, and I think they have high hopes for him. I know if you talk to people around the league, and then it comes as a surprise to a lot of people, but a lot of people around the league like Derek Carr better than Teddy Bridgewater. And I know that the stats don't seem to back that up, and I know some of the tape you'll watch and you'll say, okay, Teddy does this better. But I think people saw how much Derek Carr improved last year, they see maybe a more limited upside with Teddy Bridgewater. So it's going to be very interesting to see those two guys. They play in the preseason, they play in the regular season, so we're certainly going to see a lot of that storyline. But certainly, I think the offense, with all those weapons we talked about, Derek Carr is the guy there that is going to make that all work or not work. And so that's kind of where the offense is either going to sink or swim based on Carr's performance.
And like the Kansas City Chiefs, though, there are questions both at right guard and right tackle that need to be answered during training camp because, you know, obviously that's going to help a young quarterback. That's going to help whatever kind of run game they're trying to put together. What are you seeing at the right side of the line at this point?
Well, I think obviously they've got the veteran Khalif Barnes, who just seems to be able to rotate anywhere, and no one really loves him as far as the fans go. But a guy that the coaches like, obviously executes his assignments. You like him a better at guard, and I think that's where he's going to start out. So obviously maybe that's something to watch, is to see if the veteran can get the job done at right guard, which is a place where really hasn't played very much. So obviously going to get pushed by John Feliciano, who's a guy who they really like. Wasn't well thought of necessarily prior to the draft, but the Raiders really like him. Mike Tice really likes him. Probably reminds him a little bit of himself, Mike Tice. John Feliciano does of Mike Tice. So, a little bit kind of question to see, okay, certainly a weakness there. What's going to happen? Which guy is going to kind of net out? I usually side with the younger guy at the beginning of camp, and then obviously later in camp, you're like, okay, wait, the veteran's still in there. So you kind of maybe think that the veteran will win out there. So I think that might be a little bit of a slow transition. At right tackle, they're moving Austin Howard back to right tackle, where he was pretty good with the Jets a couple years ago. I think he'll probably win out there, which doesn't bode well for Manelik Watson, the former second-round pick of the Raiders a couple years ago. I think he is, you know, squarely on the bubble now, which is, you know, unfortunate to have kind of pick, second-round pick that's not netting out just a couple years after. But, you know, at this point, he should really be pushing harder for the job. And I don't see that happening at this point. But I could be surprised, but I don't see that right now.
Turning to the defense, obviously Khalil Mack is awesome. It's very obvious.
Yes.
But I'm curious about the rest of the defense, because you've got the, you know, the ageless yet 38 years old Charles Woodson. You have Justin Tuck there now. You know, you have a few questions you need to answer at the cornerback position. You know, what do you see happening with this defense? You know, because you've got these younger guys mixed with your Woodsons and your Justin Tucks, and how is that going to work out?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I think one of the weaknesses they had last year was, you know, middle linebacker. They obviously, you know, talk about Nick Roach having the concussion issues and
right.
not being able to play was huge for them. So they brought in Curtis Lofton, who really hasn't, you know, has kind of have off and on years, last few years, really, mm-hmm. you know, is interesting. But the weird thing is Jack Del Rio has a weird way of always seem to be able to get production out of that position. So it's kind of a strange thing. We're going to have to see how that works out, because, you know, no one knew of Brandon Marshall or Danny Trevathan in these last couple of years, the guys that really, you know, burst onto the scene for the Broncos. And, you know, Del Rio had a big part of that. And if you go back to, you know, the way that he was with the Jaguars, you talk about mm-hmm. the linebackers that he developed there. So it'll be interesting to see what he can do with the veteran like Curtis Lofton and kind of get that middle linebacker spot. I like the defensive line. You talk about, you got some young guys there, some solid players as well. They brought in, obviously, second-round pick Murray Edwards Jr., brought in Dan Williams. Justin Ellis is a guy that they drafted last year that they really like. And then you got Justin Tuck there. So maybe not a flashy one, but one that is perfectly suited for a Del Rio defense. You like, you know, guys that can take up space, you know, threaten the gaps a little bit, but not necessarily have to threaten the edge. And you obviously Mac, but, you know, a guy that's going to be there. But really, you mentioned the secondary is where you're like, okay, what's going on here? Because you've got a Charles Woodson who you just don't know when it's going to, you know, kind of the rails are going to fall off for a guy. At his age, it could happen at any time.
Absolutely.
But then you talk about the cornerback position, and last couple years they've gone with veterans with some young guys mixed in. This year, it's just the young guys.
Yeah.
You know, DJ Hayden's going to have to step up. They've got Keith McGill. He's going to have to step up. Travis Carey. I know they like some. I know they like these guys, but there's certainly a concerning, you know, position when you look at none of these guys are proven. None of them have very much experience. And that's a scary thing in a division with Peyton Manning and Phillip Rivers, especially. So
yeah.
Very, very peculiar. And then obviously they gave a lot of money to Nate Allen, who, not a lot of people thought that highly of to kind of come in and play next to Charles Woodson. So very strange secondary. And, mm-hmm. you know, say what you want about Mack even making a big jump, but not necessarily a ton of pass rush to kind of disguise those guys.
Right.
So that's where you're going to have to be like, okay, if these guys in the secondary don't step up, you know, this defense is not going to be very good. But if they step up, then okay, with Mack and Tuck and Woodson, if he doesn't fall off, and heck, if Nate Allen is anything that they think close to what, you know, they paid him, then you're like, okay, maybe it could be all right. So certainly a talent, you know, level on the defense still certainly needs some work, but they're working. They obviously have some young players that they like, and they're going to work up from there. Obviously building around Mack, you know, that's a good piece to work around. So they're going to work around him, and they've got a lot of defensive minds in that room, obviously, with not just Del Rio being the head coach, but bringing in Ken Norton Jr. from Seattle. So they got a lot of different philosophies trying to kind of meld there. But they have some good players now, some good talent at least. And so they're going to start kind of building up, because certainly that defense has not been very good at all. We said something about the talent on the offense, but really the defense has been depleted the last few years. And now we're starting to see that build back up. So very interesting team. A team that could still not be very good, but certainly be improved. So a very interesting team in the AFC West. And, you know, they weren't very competitive till the end of last year, and they got competitive. So I'd expect a more competitive team this year with the additions that they've made.
Plus, they play the Steelers, so you know that the Raiders are probably good for a win there. Because for some reason, in recent years, that has been an overarching theme between those two teams.
Yeah, I guess it must be payback for some for something that happened in the maybe in the 70s. You know, maybe some popular NFL play in NFL lore or something.
Yeah, some sort of
I don't know, but certainly been a strange phenomenon the way that the Steelers just can't seem to put the Raiders away. Yeah.
Well, we really appreciate you joining us this week to help us make sense of this fabulous AFC West division, Chris. We definitely appreciate that.
Yeah, absolutely. Great stuff.
All right, thanks. I appreciate you guys having me.
Of course.
Certainly enjoy being on every time I'm on, so thanks, guys and gals.
Yeah. Before we let you go, let our listeners know where they can find you around the old interwebs.
Right now, yeah, it's a bit of a different place than probably last time I was on.
Obviously, you can
find my Raiders work at
RaidersBlog.com.
And I'll follow on Twitter, Chris Hansen NFL, and I'll have probably an announcement on. Obviously, right now I'm between different places, but you can obviously find my Raiders work at RaidersBlog.com. I'll have some stuff there for training camp and such. But keep an eye out on my Twitter, Chris Hansen NFL, for kind of where some of my other work will be. Be featured here in the very near future.
All right,
excellent
stuff.
Well, thanks so much for joining us. Enjoy the rest of your little preseason time here, because before we know it, it's going to be full-on NFL
hot
season.
Heavy.
Yes.
Yes, it's going crazy, and I love that part of the season, so we'll certainly enjoy.
Great. Well, thanks for joining us, and have a wonderful night.
All right, thanks. I know how to hack a jeweler board in our computers. I meditate like a Buddhist, holy ramen noodles. And now you sleep, I'm inside your room with a lot of shooters. You wake up to this chopper tunas like cock-a-doodle. I'm aqua cuckoo, I turn your fruit loop to chocolate yoo-hoo. I'm hotter than Honolulu, glory unto you. Glory. And we're back here at the F-Ball NFL Podcast. Another big thank you to Chris Hansen from Raiders Blog for joining us to help us preview the AFC West this evening.
Great stuff.
Make sure you, if you're not already, you give him a follow on Twitter. He's a great NFL mind, not just about the AFC West, though he does know that division quite well, but the entire National Football League. Of course, those divisional previews will continue next week, so make sure you stay tuned for that. We'll try to have ourselves another great guest. Hopefully one that can rival the how well we've done so far, first with Ty Schalter with the NFC North and now with Chris Hansen with the AFC West.
I'm fairly confident we can
I'm fairly confident we can do that. So yeah, training camps are underway, so that's a good thing to look forward to here in the next week. I'm sure we'll have a lot of other interesting non-deflated football related news to discuss when we return next week to this here podcast. Until then, thank you all for listening. I'm your host here. I am Andrea Hengst. I cover the Browns and the Steelers for BleacherReport.com. I cover the Browns for the Orange and Brown Report at Scout.com. That's at CLE.Scout.com. I also cover the entire NFL for Sports on Earth. That's SportsOnEarth.com. And you can find me on Twitter at FBall_Andrea, FBALL_Andrea.
And as always, because
I
haven't changed it or anything, I'm at BFAT65 on Twitter. That's at BFAT65. And look for me there occasionally.
Occasionally.
I've been a little more active the last couple
weeks. Yeah, you have been a little more active.
And I'll pick it up, you know, obviously as the season goes.
Well, of course, again, a big thank you to Chris Hansen for joining us this week. And a big thank you to all of you for listening, because we always enjoy having you either regular, frequent, infrequent, or maybe even first-time listeners. We appreciate all of you here at the F-Ball NFL Podcast. Training camps will continue, so keep an eye on that. Hopefully, knock on wood, we don't have any significant training camp injuries.
You just
always
jinxed it.
It's always just so
coming tomorrow now.
Oh, no. It's always just so depressing. It's the worst part of the offseason.
Hopefully,
think,
there won't
me.
Be too much of that, at least.
Hopefully, not too much of that. So, yeah, training camps continue. Football approaches, and we appreciate you guys checking in here at the F-Ball NFL Podcast this week. So, until next week, enjoy your summer. And
later.
My tie is Lucas, my driver's cruising, my partner's rootless, my flower's rootless, my pocket's roofless, she popping Rufus. I'm not a student, I'm not assuming, I'm not a human, you are not immune to this kind of music. You got him, don't you? You got him, don't you? I got him.